You could save big when you bundle your home and auto with Progressive, but when we just come out and say it, it feels like it falls a bit flat. So we're going to use humor. But we don't want to insult your intelligence, so nothing too goofy. And we need to avoid any polarizing topics. Oh, and it has to be about how you can save big when you bundle your home and auto with Progressive. You know what? Maybe humor is a bad idea. Yeah, it's never going to work. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discount not available in all states or situations.
How you doing, everyone? Thank you for tuning into this episode of Ready to Record from Blue Girl Studios, proudly sponsored by VFX Unleashed, powered by Amarillo College and SemCorp Productions. My name is Daniel the D3 Cohen. I'm your host, and I'm speaking to you from Blue Girl Productions worldwide headquarters and studios here in my garage. I'm a 20-year-old aspiring musician, engineer, and producer, and like many of you guys, I make music out of my own home studio. You know, some of today's biggest hitmakers work from home studios, so maybe we can help one of you accomplish your big dreams. Now, before we get into the episode, I want to talk about our sponsor, VFX Unleashed, powered by Amarillo College and SemCorp Productions. VFX Unleashed is a complete accredited online VFX school where you can learn how to have a career in the visual effects industry in classes taught by industry professionals. There are programs in all major aspects of VFX production and software, including Photoshop, After Effects, Maya, Nuke, Cinema 4D, and many more. Online, fully remote classes start every 8 weeks, and a full VFX studio within Amarillo College's Innovation Outpost will open next year, which will have a state-of-the-art soundstage and motion capture studio. You can check out all that VFX Unleashed has to offer and enroll today at VFXUnleashed.com. Thank you to VFX Unleashed and SemCorp for being our very first sponsor. We are proud to have you. Now, let's get into the show. Today on the show, we have drummer Mr. Wally Ingram. In trying to find ways to describe Wally Ingram to all of you, all I could really think of was man, myth, legend. And really, that's no lie. Wally is something of a legend in the recording industry and the music industry in general, having done a lot of work with Sheryl Crow and many others. I mean, when your motto is, when in doubt, just add Wally, I think it speaks for itself. Certainly in my own friend group of people like Dusty Wakeman, Phil Milner, Tree Adams, and many more, Wally is something of... He is quite the legend and a dear friend to all of them. And certainly, having so much in common with Wally, it's been a lot of fun to do this conversation with him. So, here is my conversation with Mr. Wally Ingram. Enjoy.
Or do you just like you edit this later on? I take it.
I do. I go relatively chronologically. You know, the Malcolm podcast, that whole bullshit, and then
okay, cool, you know, gotcha.
And then ask a series of questions. The thing that I do, you know, like I stayed up. The one thing that there are two things that my father does for me, and then I do everything else. He books the interviews, and some of them I've done myself, and then he'll gather up some links and some video for me to look at,
research,
and watch.
Know what you're talking about.
And then after that, I spend, you know, 4 to 6 hours on the research. So I was up till 4 in the morning making sure I had everything prepared. And it's not just, you know, reading research, and especially when it's somebody, you know, that I already kind of have a grasp on, you know, like I told you in my email yesterday, I had Adam Hirsch on and Phil Milner and all those guys, and you know, I didn't have to spend hours and hours
and
researching
Dusty.
Them. Yeah. And Dusty.
Yeah, those are all my pals right there.
And all from
who I've worked actually with each one of those guys in the last month.
That's funny.
You know, Bill, I was recorded up at his studio.
I'd seen that.
Yeah. That was fun.
What project was that for?
It was for his wife.
Oh, that was for Jenny's shit.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
Phil and Jenny I've known for a long time because Eric McFadden used to live with them in the city, and I've worked with Eric for many, many years, and that's how I met them. And I've done some recording with Jenny before, and I'm with Phil at the helm, and we're just good friends. So she's working on some new stuff and was wanting to maybe do it Wally Track style, and then it turned out, I said, well, look, I'm coming up to the Bay Area to do a couple of gigs, and maybe we could just do it there. And it worked out. So I kind of slid it in between a couple of gigs up there, which was great. I got to lay eyes on them and be in the same room and all that business. And Phil's got a really great technique, you know. He's got cool mics, cool environment, and you know, just being there. Have you been to their place?
I grew up in that place. Phil's the reason I'm a recording engineer.
My god.
Okay, so
you should be recording this.
I am. So So in 2013, I met them in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And my father made this deal with them, like, I'll do some managing help. How about you give the kid lessons? So Jenny gave me some guitar and vocal lessons and tried to get me into writing lessons. But the problem with me and like she tried to help me with lyric writing, and it was cool. But the problem with me in lyric writing is I have my father, and I don't know if you've heard my father's lyrics before, but they're very, very, very different from the way that Jenny writes.
Yeah, tell me about your dad's lyric writing.
Well, he started in New York in the '80s in the jam band scene. He was one of those offshoots of the Grateful Dead, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, he was in the scene with John O'Manson and Blues Traveler, Spin Doctors, and the Hatters. Dyer
Brothers, the Hatters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Actually, Tom Kalin, the drummer of the Hatters, was in his band first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And if you know Groove Collective, the acid jazz hip hop thing from the 90s,
yeah,
you know that name.
Yep.
Their percussionist, Snappy G / rapper, was again in my father's band. Like all these guys kind of started off in my father's world of Columbia University jam band acid trip thing.
See, I know your dad from his management. I mean, he was full on in management and
music
handling
Music Unlimited days, or the
he was managing Jono, and before then
I
know he was
Mother Hips.
Okay. Yep. And then I'm not sure exactly when I met him, but Blues Traveler and I were really pretty good friends because I was working with Sheryl Crow, and we were all on A&M Records, and we were, we put together for a double bill tour, which just kind of skyrocketed all of us. We're kind of simultaneous path to success at that time, and we just killed this, I don't know, 2 or 3 month theater tour together, sold out everything, and got to become great friends. And Blues Traveler ended up hiring me to run the workshop stage on the Horde tour for a couple of years. And I know, I'm not exactly sure when I met Billy, but it was somewhere in all that. And I used to do gigs with Bob Sheehan and John O'Manson and High Plains Drifter, kind of this combo of you know, jam band folks together, but I'm not exactly sure when I met Billy. I don't know when he fit into the whole mix, but I knew David Graham, and I know that those guys were
they were
partners, right?
Kind of. Well, ish. My father worked for Music Unlimited.
Bill, right?
Initially he worked for Music Unlimited, and then ish. How did that work? I think in the late 80s, after my dad graduated, he worked for David as Music Unlimited. Then his band broke up 89-90. And Bill heard that the band was done. He was elated. He went, come work for me.
Okay.
And then my father was out here in the spring, by the spring of 90, and then came back to New York the fall of 90 because he wanted to be with his grandmother and was homesick, and then worked for David for that year as Music Unlimited in New York. And then Bill died and David flew out here, and David tasked my father of driving his van out from New York to California.
Sounds about right.
And he never went back.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that sounds about right. So we've had lots of run-ins, and I'm a big fan. I've yet to play music with your dad, which is something that needs to happen.
My dad is not really a musician. He's a lyricist, but he's...
Okay, because he considers himself... Is he in a band right now?
No, he was... Okay. No, I've had him... Actually, I'll send you what he's done some stuff with me. I'll send you some of that. Actually, it's funny. Tree Adams' daughter sang on the thing that I'm going to send you, and he's actually been kind of
Josephine.
Yeah, Joe sang on my song.
Wow, Joe and my daughter Lydia are really good friends. They met in circ school together, doing circus arts, and a few years ago, and then they are they're really good friends. As a matter of fact, my daughter joined them in Paris for a week this summer.
Nice.
They were kind enough to invite her, and Tree and I do a lot of work together, and we're in a band now, Diagnosticus.
Yeah.
We've got a real family connection with those guys, and sounds like you do too.
When you're hanging out and you're interviewing Tree Adams and Billy J. Stein, both before and after the record, talk about, you know, it being 1994 and they're crashing on your father's floor. you know, it's a family affair.
Absolutely. Yeah. 94 was a landmark year. I'd say, I think that was the year that I started playing with Sheryl Crow. And, so we were on a, you know, parallel path kind of. And Sheryl was really, she wasn't a pop star yet. She was really, you know, carving her own niche. And our band was, you know, a good fit for, you know, what would become the jam band scene. I mean, we were kind of like playing in clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And we were a rock band, and we were not trying to sound like the album, and we were not trying to be a pop band by any means. And we were jamming, and it was pretty killer. It was kind of a good fit when they connected us with Blues Traveler. And because they already had this really great built-in audience, and we were kind of just searching for an audience. And then all of a sudden she started getting some airplay and videos started hitting. And then at some point we realized, oh, we are kind of a, I don't know if it's called pop band, but we're definitely popular music at that point. And, you know, having to like pay a little bit more attention to playing songs a little more like the record and and jumping through all the hoops that you do when you're in part of the promotional machinery,
right?
You know, with big record companies and stuff. But yeah. So 94, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, right around then, that was this whole run of the Horde Tour and, you know, Blues Traveler guys became really good friends of mine. Bob Sheehan was one of my very best friends. And I actually, oddly enough, met my wife in his house in New Orleans. A mutual friend introduced us, and, you know, it's that kind of thing. So,
the real definition of a family affair.
Yeah, absolutely. And when Billy reached out to me and asked me if I would do a podcast with his son, I'm like, wow, sure. I'd love to hear more about you, whether or not, I mean, I could probably spend an hour interviewing you about what you're doing. So I'm playing catch up, but, and then I kind of had a look at who you're interviewing and all these kind of audio recording legends. I'm like, whoa, well, I've got my own little slice of the, recording world going on here, but more from artist side, I guess, or drummer percussion role. And I do my best to surround myself with great engineers and technical people when I can get them. And if I can't get them in here, I have some virtual, I've got one particular engineer who gets on with me virtually, and we've actually do sessions that way. I could probably let you do the line of questioning, but I will say this, that they have set me up quite nicely with like templates for different applications. I have a great live room. I have great microphones. We've upgraded every system during the pandemic and, you know, taking PPP money and trying to just get everything. It's, what do you do when your job's been kind of taken away? You know, when you can't
right.
work, you just have to do something, survive. I've always wanted to have a great studio, and I'd already kind of been, you know, putting it together, but it really did give me the focus to build this thing. And now really my challenge is going to be learning, you know, really, how to be a engineer as well, and how to handle the technology behind it. I've got to go to school. I've got to just sit down and put my time in. I can get around a little bit, but, you know, I can also get into trouble real fast. So that's kind of where I'm at.
I've been sitting behind a recording desk for nearly a decade, and even I still get into trouble.
Nearly a decade since you were 9 years old.
Yeah. Phil sold me. How I got into recording was Phil called me one day. I was middle of 2013. I was 11. Yeah. and he said, I have an old, I'm upgrading my rig. I have an old one I got to get rid of. You want it? Sure. How much? $400. I have that in my back pocket. Sure.
11.
So we had dinner. We
paper
had
paper out money, right?
Yeah.
Or something.
Pay cash money. So a couple days later went and ate Moroccan food with him and Jenny at the house on Baker Street. And nice. And he set up the first session on the computer for me and explained the basics of how to get around the computer, which I already knew, but it was his rig, and so he wanted to like make sure I was all well and thoroughly versed in it. And I paid him $300 up front and took a rig home that night.
That's cool, man. I can't think of a cooler like teacher. I mean, Phil is like such a gearhead and like interesting guy and great musician. And I mean, he can like takes anything apart and put it back together and fix things. And
I apprenticed in his shop. Everybody knows me ever since I was like 15 years old as a technician's apprentice. Why? Because I was in Phil's shop. I was his apprentice.
Did you ever spend time at Hate Street Music over there?
I was in there almost every day. Now I wasn't there when Phil was, but everybody knew that I worked for Phil in his little shop in his garage.
Which Eric McFadden lived a few feet away.
Yeah. I was in there. I started in there about a year and a half after he moved out of the basement.
Oh, after Eric did. Yeah. Okay.
But the funny thing is, even though he moved out of the basement, because you got to remember, this is the Delphine years, right?
Okay. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. Let's yeah.
So Eric had already moved out of the basement because he got a apartment or a room or something with Delphine in LA. But the funny thing is, even though he didn't live there, quote unquote, anymore,
he had a lot of stuff there.
Oh, God. Fucking
artwork, guitars, amps,
underwear. like I was hanging out with Phil. We went and got
wardrobe, masks.
Yeah.
Clown stuff.
Jimmy's, you know.
lots of clown paraphernalia.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that was interesting, I mean, the way I met Phil and Jenny was because I would go pick up Eric for gigs. And I'm like, wow, what a cool house, man. Wow, these people are incredible. This, what great. Mm-hmm. And then Eric had his little space, kind of little dungeon hideout in the basement, which kind of worked well for him because he's a day sleeper. And I don't even know if there was a window in there. I can't remember.
There was one window and the paper mache zebra.
Yeah. And he had a collection of artwork, pretty amazing stuff, paintings and things he found and collected. Amazing wardrobe and amazing guitars. And you can just imagine what this place looked like. I'm thrilled to hear this backstory on you, Daniel, that Phil, Billy and Jenny had their effect on you as a young man and still do, obviously.
Yeah.
It explains a lot about where you've come from and knowing your dad. It's like, the stage is set. The stage is set here.
More or less, but can I tell you the funniest thing that nobody, that barely anybody believes?
Sure.
As a college student, I did not go in for music or anything music industry related. I'm a computer science major.
You know what? Your dad, maybe, I don't know who influenced you on that, but that's a pretty smart move. I mean, I actually didn't, I didn't go to school for music either. I was trying to figure out what, in the end, I probably could have ended up with some kind of a minor if somebody were able to tally it up like that. I did a ton of music coursework, but I landed in the communication arts school, the University of Wisconsin, Madison, which was a really great program. And normally, I did a little bit of radio, television, film stuff, but I became passionately interested in what they, at the time, called a communication specialist program, but it was really communication and human behavior. So it was kind of thing that was like a perfect prerequisite for being a therapist or a business master's or a lawyer, that kind of thing. So I'm really not sure how I got there other than looking for courses my freshman year there wasn't much available, and you literally had to physically go to different buildings on campus, huge campus, 40,000 students, and you had to like take this piece of paper and like run or take your bike across campus to the whatever building you were trying to get in and get in a line. And if you're lucky enough to get into that class, they'd stamp your schedule and then you'd move on to the next place. So one, I was able to get in this biggest class on campus, in the biggest lecture hall on campus, called Communication and Human Behavior. And ComArts 150, I think it was, with David Mortensen. And it was a life-changing experience to me. It was like literally, like the second week of class was the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life by John Hinckley. And so the backstory on that, I don't know, it was just kind of crazy. And the teacher said, he handed out 3x5 cards and he said, okay, write down what you're thinking about this, like what's your most powerful thought about your reaction to this. And then he ended up writing a book based on kind of that idea, like all these people saying, you know, like a lot of people had wished that he would have, you know, done the job and actually, you know, killed the president. It was like all this crazy stuff. Anyway, the whole way of documenting violent behavior and just interpersonal communication and conflict resolution and all these kind of things somehow just appealed to me, oddly enough. So I went pretty full into the communication and human behavior world. And meanwhile, I got finally into the Black Music Ensemble with Richard Davis, the great bass player,
mm-hmm.
who ran the, you know, bass program and the Black Music History program and Black Music Ensembles. And I got into his, when I finally got into his world my junior year, I went through like five semesters of history and, or four semesters of history and five semesters of Black Music Ensemble, and he became a mentor, as did the communication arts professor became a mentor of mine too. So I was in really good hands. And I think those skills, that skill set, which I never pursued, like in business or, you know, I think I used it all the time in being in bands, like how to deal with personalities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the thing that I've heard from a number of people who didn't decide to pursue music as their, you know, chosen profession or whatever, and that they didn't study it in school and didn't have that career path as their schooling education, is that, you know, people still use their degrees in the industry. It's just most people don't think that they use them directly because they're not directly in the profession that they studied to be in, or they're not down that path or whatever. But a lot of people do directly use their degrees, even if they don't think they are.
Yeah, I completely forgot about it. And then later on, I would realize, wow, I think I'm using some of the skill set, conflict resolution. Yeah, when you're the drummer in the band, you're either a guy who creates a lot of conflict, and then generally you're really, you know, disposable. Yeah. Otherwise, you're the guy who's like kind of the glue, helps be part of the glue, keep things together. And that's, I've been lucky enough to be that guy for the most part, with probably a few exceptions. But I think that, yeah, it's like being, I also loved sports when I was younger, and I was not cut out to be a professional athlete by any means, but I definitely love sports and love team sports. And I think being in a band is a great, it's kind of like being in on a basketball team, or, you know, being some kind of a sports situation. You got to know how to pass the ball. You got to play defense. You got to, you know, you got to know how to score. And, you know, you're a team. You got to, you do the thing together. And I've always liked that analogy with being in a band.
And I think, you know, I know people who've said that being in a band is much like a football team or a baseball team or something like that. But, you know, one of those. But something that I realized is that, you know, it is kind of more like being on a basketball or a soccer team, in that, not that while you're playing for the audience, you're also kind of, if you think about it as a team sport, you're playing against the audience in a way. You're trying to, because they're both the audience and the opposing team in a way, if that makes sense. Because, like, if you make a wrong move, they can steal the ball and can get on your offensive, and then you have to musically defend and get them back to enjoying themselves. You know, I've seen a couple of wrong notes or a poorly played song get the audience, you know, in a bad state of mind. You have to kind of get the ball back from them or try and change their heart, you know.
Well, I agree, and there's also, I guess, something to be said about being being a home team, or playing in a, they talk about playing, you know, when you're a visitor and you're playing at a stadium that's a tough place to play. Like, if you're playing the Raiders and you're dealing with the Raiders fans, you know, you're never going to win them over. So you're going to have to try to win, steal the game, kind of. But different. Right. Different venues are challenging themselves, whether or not you're like in competition with anybody. It's like, you know, okay, so it's a challenge to go and play like the Lakers, you know, you and these should go play in Boston. It's like a challenge to play in a venue that's really boomy, for instance, or has a bad PA system, or has a, you know, just not good sight lines, or, you know, or you're playing in a club and there's a freaking pole in the middle of the stage, or there's things like that. We just have to work with whatever your environment is and get yourself through the gig, or like bad monitor system, or an engineer that's not working out for you, or, you know, sound issues, things like that. The challenges that go in to doing live performances, and you need, not only is your team on stage with you, your band, but your team is your engineers, your crew guys, your drum techs and guitar techs. You know, you break a string, you know, you, what do? You got to have somebody there to hand you another guitar or change the string quick, or, you know, something goes bad. You get a bad chord somewhere in line. DI is not working. What, you know, it's like, it's a full effort. It's like your trainers and your coaches and all that. The people that, I mean, I know almost everybody that's in the industry, you think about that a lot. Audience members, audiences don't always think about that. It's something that I'm pretty passionate about, is trying to be a voice for crew people and acknowledge them. And I think that in the pandemic, I mean, they've been affected as much or as anybody in, you know, work-wise. For, you know, even myself, I'm able to, like, you know, somebody sends me a project, I can record on it and send it, you know. But if you're a live monitor engineer and that's what you do, or you're a guitar tech or something, you're not, you know, when the gig's shut down, you're not working. Just right. Simply not working. You're looking for a new career. You know, you're like probably working for Amazon or something like that. Or, you know, I know some of the venues that when they began opening up, a lot of them are shutting back down again, but, you know, looking for riggers and people that, you know, with union people that would stage hands and lighting people and stuff, that have actually out of necessity had to move on. So I think that we really need to be aware of that and just, I don't know. I'm kind of in a situation right now, Daniel, where I'm trying to pull myself up by the bootstraps again because I was really excited about the way things were going. And I had spent a lot of time getting together a bunch of great Jazz Fest gigs. We're all lining up and things looked like they were moving forward. And that was a big blow when Jazz Fest was canceled. And then something like a Hurricane Ida comes along and you're just all of a sudden you're going, damn, you know, who even, you know, at that point you're more worried about your friends and the people of New Orleans and now the people all across, you know, all the areas affected by the hurricane and by the flooding and stuff. It's like, what's really important in life? It's like people are fighting for their lives and have no power, you know, and on top of that, the whole, you know, our profession has been kind of wiped out or sidelined for a while. It's just like, oh my God, it's a crazy, crazy time. And we're going on what, 2 years now? It's really just about, it's coming up on 2 years.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And we don't know what's going to happen next. It's going to get better before it gets worse. I mean, it's kind of, well, right now it looks like worse before better, sadly. But I'm kind of like, oh wow, I better now again refocus again on recording and what I can do, what I can do on the home front, and try to facilitate some cool interactive musical experiences with people even from afar.
Yeah, totally. You
know, kind of amazing that we're doing things like this, these, you know, the podcasts and Zoom meetings and all these other kind of interactions. I bet you know a thing or two about high quality interacting through the internet. I know there's been a lot of work kind of recently to try to upgrade the interactability of, you know, musicians trying to play together. If not real time, but I think it's moving that way a little bit, right?
It's seeming to start to. I know some people have done. I even saw some friends of mine do a Zoom jam session. I don't know how well it went. I mean, I watched it, but even so, you know, I'm not sure. From the audience perspective, it seemed okay, but you know, I've never actually talked to the two guys who were jamming via Zoom and you know, trying to do the thing well, you know, like, were you playing ahead of the beat and trying to like predict when it was going to be? Were you playing on the beat? Like how are you doing that, you know?
It's hard to, I guess if you could play some, you know, adjust the kind of music you were doing where you didn't actually have to be locked in completely, that would be one way to do it. I don't know how far we are away from that kind of thing happening. I know Bob Weir and his camp over at TRI, somebody had told me that you had to be within, I don't know how far, but it was like some kind of a range and you had to have the right technology and it was possible, but I'm not sure how far that range was. It certainly wasn't like around the world. It was like, I hate to even speculate, but I feel like it was like 500 miles, which is not that crazy. I mean, you could be in San Francisco and LA if that's what it was. Really don't know. If this was a call-in show, I would throw that out there and say, hey, does anybody know about that? Phil would probably know. Phil Billy might know.
He might.
Somebody at TRI would certainly know about that. I think it's
I'm curious if our dear friend and colleague Tree Adams would know, because he's got the he told me about it. He has his rig, and then one of his engineers, like his chief engineer, has a matching rig at his place, and they're linked so that they can be looking at the same sessions.
Well, that, yeah, and Tria, we've been doing some stuff together. Not in real time, though. He sends me files, and then I send them off back to him and one of his assistant engineers, and then they kind of reset it up. But we haven't really tried to do something together in real time. My engineers, I've got a couple of different engineers that can get on my computer via Zoom, and just like I share my screen with them, and they can be in my control room or like looking at the kind of handling, like it's as if they're in the control room. Mm-hmm. I'm in the drum room, and they're actually still able to talk back to me even through the talk back,
right?
And kind of run the session. I mean, it's a little bit glitchy. I don't think they're hearing great. My good pal Jay Vatuk, who lives in the East Bay now, and he's a producer, engineer, musician I've known since college days, mm-hmm. and he said he had his finger on the pulse of some pretty high quality audio, kind of zoomy technology. I don't know, it might be similar to this Zencaster thing you're using, but I don't know. It's one of those things that's going to be ongoing, I think.
Yeah.
Get better.
Yeah.
Let's face it. We all want to play music live, and we want to play for the people, and you want to record with people live, you know, or in the room if you can.
Right.
That's optimal. But it's a pivot, so to speak.
It is. You know, I'm fortunate to have, you know, I mean, we're in California, which is right now surging, but I have a group of people who I can trust, which is good. And we're all down with the vaccines. And when booster shots become available to us, which actually my little cousin who's kind of immunocompromised, she had kidney failure. She was only 14 when she had kidney failure, but
oh my God.
And ended up getting a kidney transplant. But she just got a booster shot. So, you know, that
fantastic.
I see this moving in the right direction, but as soon as the booster shots become available for me and everybody else, I'm definitely jumping on the bandwagon. Anyway, I have a number of people I can trust, and of course, you know, even though we're all vaccinated, it's still a risk, but at this point there is a number of the, you know, I don't want to take too many risks. I'm not one to really love that.
Yeah, but, I'm, you know. I mean, on that front, as soon as I was able to get vaccinated, I went for it. I'm a stage 4 cancer survivor, now coming up on 15 years, head and neck cancer. So I probably would qualify for a booster.
Probably.
Maybe sooner than later. I don't know. I haven't really looked into that. I probably should soon. But and as soon as my daughter was, she's 15 now, but when she was when it was came available, I can't remember if it was for 14-year-olds or 15-year-olds. But anyways, she wanted to do it. It was kind of her decision. I mean, we're all for it. I have a real hard time, unless somebody has some kind of a situation that it's truly a health risk concern. And I do have a friend that had a bad reaction, musician friend of mine who has asthma, and he had a pretty scary bad reaction to the first vaccination, and he's very hesitant about completing it. And I think it's really taken a toll. It's like, because he's not vaccinated completely, and he's just, it's kind of tearing him up. And it's also like he can't technically go do a gig that you need to be fully vaccinated. It's just like, what? And then there are some people I've heard, you know, they don't want to do it. They don't want to do it. The sad thing is that these are the people that end up in the hospital, you know. And then there's kids that are all these kids that are going back to school that can't get vaccinated. And there a lot of them are going to get sick. And it's just going to be, it's, I don't know, the risk factor is significant, as we all know.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really holding up our industry. I mean, at this point, you know, I could be the cheerleader. Come on, everybody, get vaccinated, and you know, life will return to normal, and I can be the nice guy. But I think I'm starting to take my father's approach. No, you're fucking with my industry. You got to do this right now. I need to make some money.
Yeah, well, I know. I just played at Terrapin Crossroads last Sunday with David Nelson Band, and they were, you know, they were very adamant about looking at everyone's vax card, and
yeah,
even David, you know, it was like David's, you know, around 80 years old, and the, you know, definitely for him, but and he didn't have it on him or something, and he was able to get a hold of it. Yeah, I mean, no one's getting in there without it. I think Northern California is really, really seems to have it be kind of leading the way.
Yeah,
the venues, and because right now it seems like that's where the gigs are, and so people and the audiences are respecting it, and that's the protocol. That to me is the way to do it. And then next weekend I'm doing a festival with Tom Freund, this Beach Life Festival, and they just asked yesterday, to, you know, email in a copy of your vax card. To 3 days with tons of bands. I mean, it's amazing lineups. It's going to be interesting to see how they manage that. I'm assuming everyone in the audience has to show their vax cards.
Right.
I don't know.
Same. Yep. Same thing. No, I had this happen myself. I had a session. It was this, group of UC San Diego students. One of my bandmates, he's been in since we were 14, 15 years old in my band. And, he went when he graduated high school to UCSD, and he's a couple years older than me. And so he graduated this year, and a couple of one of his classmates from his old music class, he went in for pre-med, basically human physiology and neuroscience was his major, but he took a lot of music courses, and I nearly got a music minor, I think. And that's a funny story for another day, because he almost didn't bring down his trombone. But he had a bunch of friends trying to do a session up here, and one of them was trying to come up, and you know, he's this 20-year-old kid from the San Diego area, and he was going to come up and produce a session with all these grad/current students who lived up here, and he wanted to do it at my place, and he did it at my place, but we had to, I had to tell him, like, look, you gotta make sure, like, you gotta prove vaccination, otherwise I'm not letting you guys into the studio, because I'm not getting sick, and more to the point, I'm not getting my parents sick, I'm not getting my immunocompromised cousins sick, like, I see my grandmother twice a month, I'm not getting her sick, like, you know, I'm not dealing with that, you have to be vaccinated. And of course everybody's from California, everybody, you know, that's the current age old thing. You want to know if somebody's vaccination status, ask who they voted for. So
right, pretty much. Yeah.
Did
anybody have a problem with it, or were you all good?
Nobody had a problem. We were all good. We went forward. It was a good session, actually. It lasted 10 hours. Kid wanted to try and do it in 5, but ended up being in 10, which was okay, because he booked me for a 10-hour session, but he was trying to be ambitious, which yeah. I respect. I can appreciate that, you know, but
absolutely.
be try to do something, but be prepared for when it fails, you know?
I get it. I've got to tell you, it's funny because a friend of mine, going back to my earliest days in Beloit, Wisconsin, where I grew up, there was a kid in my neighborhood. I was about 9. He and his brother were 7, and they were adopted, and they were adopted to a sociology professor at Beloit College. And we just kind of ran around. I met when we were riding bikes in the neighborhood.
As one does.
Didn't think that much about these guys. I loved them. They were friends, and we just kind of ran around. And then years later, I was asked to put together a band for a show at the high school and to raise money for the homecoming events or something. And so I was looking to put together a band, and somebody I hooked up with a couple of musicians, and I said, man, we need a singer. And somebody said, oh, have you ever heard Ron Froese sing? And I'm like, Ron Froese? I mean, he sings? And it was like a kid in my neighborhood, you know? And it's like, oh, yeah, he's a great singer. I'm like, oh, wow. I think he was 13 at the time, and I was 15. And he's an amazing singer. He sings, he could sing like all the rock stuff, all the pop stuff, soulful, just really soulful singer, almost in like Stevie Wonder kind of category. But at any rate, he and I have done tons of things throughout our lives, and he is very into the audio world and is coming over here in about 45 minutes. He will be arriving, and we're going to be working on some presets for his new, well, not so new, but for his one of his plugins. His name is he took his dad's first name, Menno Froese, and his company is called Ayaic, AYAIC. Is that it? AYAI. We have to look it up.
Don't they make the Mix Monolith?
Exactly. Have you heard of it?
Yes.
Yeah, the Mix Monolith and the COS, Ceilings of Sound. Matter of fact, I think it's the Mix Monolith. We're going to do a Wally Trax presets based on my Wally Trax percussion drum library that's on Yurt Rock. And so he's going to be over here in about probably about an hour. And I told him about you yesterday that we're scheduling time for him to come. I said, oh, maybe Daniel should speak with you sometime, because you know, the whole recording arts thing, he's a genius. He's got this vision, followed it through. He's a great musician, but he's really taking on this technology, and he's got like big plans to do something like, he says, 15 more plugins, and he's got it all mapped out what he wants to do next, and he wants to do a drum machine and whatnot. But we've had the dream together of being in music since we were teenagers, and we're, you know, I'm almost 60 years old, and he's like in his mid 50s. And we're still doing it, and we're still supportive of each other. And that's kind of what it's all about. I mean, you get people like that in your life, like Jay Vatuk as well. Jay was in our band, Electro Love Kit, together in college. And then Jay and I moved to California around the same time, and we ended up with a studio together. And he produced 3 of the David Lindley, Wally Ingram duo records, and he did a duo record with Jerry Joseph and I, and Jay's gone on to be production manager at the Belly Up in Aspen, and then he moved on from that to become work with Michael Fronte doing his production work, every aspect of it, and he's just that guy, you know. And our team, he helped me work on the Wally Trax library along with my engineer, Sid Greenbaum. And it's just great when, I mean, you got people like that that you've known since you were, you know, about your age now, for sure. I think I met Jay about when I was maybe 20. And to know that a lot of these guys are still doing it, are pursuing it, is pretty cool. I'm going to definitely introduce you to a handful of people that are in my camp that I think would be interesting to speak with for your podcast regarding engineering and music.
I've been having a lot of fun sharing this conversation with you, and it has been super duper cool to have Wally on the show. Having his insights and his background, both as a drummer and a producer and a studio musician in general and as a whole, has been really fun to talk to him and talk about all the things that he's done and all the ways to go about being a drummer and producer in today's modern remote recording world. Now, this conversation will pick back up, and it will have some really kooky, crazy stuff go on along the way, too. But we have a special break in the action, which is why we've been delayed in releasing this episode. This week, the week of May 30th, 2022, we are headed down to NAMM 2022, where we will be covering as media and giving you guys an inside look at what is going on and what is new at NAMM 2022. There will be a lot of familiar voices and friends of the podcast, as well as some new people and some really cool gear from really cool companies. Now, while there may not be more music to geek out on next time, there will certainly be a lot of gear too. So tune in for all of our NAMM 2022 coverage, where we will be going through every bit of pro audio that we can get our hands on and we can talk to. For now, though, this is Daniel the D3 Cohen signing off from Blue Girls Productions worldwide headquarters and studios here in San Francisco, California. We're ready to record.
This is Claudia's O'Reilly Auto Parts story.
I had just moved to a new city and barely even knew where the grocery store was yet. When my car wouldn't start one morning, I didn't know who to ask about local shops. But I remembered a name from back home, O'Reilly Auto Parts. I called and they pointed me to a great mechanic just down the street. Now I feel a little more at home.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $700 on average, and those savings add up. Imagine what you could buy in the future.
Hey, remember how 20 years ago I switched to Progressive? Well, now it's the future, and I used all those savings to buy this new hologram phone. Because, you know, it's the future, and everything is holograms now.
So switch to Progressive and save big, because those savings can add up in the future. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customer surveyed who saved with Progressive in 2020. Potential savings will vary.